Rigolet against Whirlpool will be argued next. Mr. Lichtenberg.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I am John Lichtenberg representing the Grigolet Company. The case before the Court concerns two issues of contract interpretation arising under a license agreement between Grigolet and Whirlpool Corporation. The first issue is, well, both issues relate to what is Grigolet entitled to recover as a result of Whirlpool's violation of that agreement. An arbitrator has already determined that Whirlpool violated the agreement, and the way this agreement was set up, an arbitrator determined the issue of liability. The courts were left to determine the issue of damages. The first issue that is presented is one that can be is whether Grigolet is entitled to recover damages as a result of work that it did not receive under the terms of the agreement, or whether it is entitled to royalties based upon some use of its patents by Whirlpool. And that question, Your Honors, we would submit can be answered by answering one very simple question, and that is, who made a promise in paragraph 3 of this license agreement? The lower court and Whirlpool have contended that it was Grigolet that promised in paragraph 3 that it would not seek collect royalties. We submit that the only appropriate reading of paragraph 3, looking at the contract as a whole, and frankly looking at paragraph 3 in particular, is that Whirlpool is the promisor in paragraph 3. One thing to keep in mind as we go through this is that this agreement arose in the context of a claim of patent infringement. Grigolet was a supplier of knobs to Whirlpool. Whirlpool decided to single source all of its knob work to another supplier. Work that was with Grigolet was going to be moved to the other supplier, and other work that Grigolet had been doing was going to be transformed into something new, also by this other supplier. And Grigolet determined that the new knobs that were going to be manufactured by the new supplier infringed upon Grigolet's patents and cried foul. The result of that, after some period of negotiation, was the license agreement that is before the court. The district court found that paragraph 3 was a conditional promise by Grigolet to not seek royalties if Whirlpool provided business required under what we have referred to in our briefs as prongs 1 and prongs 2, prong 1 and prong 2 of paragraph 3. Indeed, the court found, and Whirlpool continues to argue, that Whirlpool made no promise whatsoever in the agreement of any performance anywhere. Instead, what the court found below was that that Grigolet was freed from what it characterized as a promise in paragraph 3 to not seek royalties. It was freed from that promise when Whirlpool failed to perform under prong 2, and that Grigolet therefore has a right to seek royalties, which heretofore it wouldn't have had otherwise because of its purported promise in paragraph 3. And this, we submit, is where the lower court erred in concluding that Grigolet was the promisor under paragraph 3, when in fact Grigolet makes no promise in paragraph 3. It is Whirlpool that makes that promise. We reached that conclusion first by looking at the agreement as a whole, which is something that we, of course, are all taught in law school that we must do. We don't look at a single paragraph, we look at the entire paragraph. The document itself is styled as an agreement. It's not an offer, it's not a proposal, it's an agreement. The parties in their recital state that they have agreed.
Counsel, I'm just lost by this line of argument. It's perfectly obvious this was an agreement. What the district court found was that Whirlpool had two possible ways of fulfilling its duties under the agreement. One was buying more knobs from Frigolet, and the other was paying royalties. That doesn't make it less an agreement. What we need to be arguing is whether the district judge was right to think that Whirlpool could choose between these two ways of carrying out its promise.
Well, Your Honor, I think in a sense that you're correct in that regard, that it would be our position that Whirlpool, in fact, did undertake, and I think the district court ruled that Whirlpool did undertake an obligation to pay royalties. That's how it ends up with the conclusion that it owes royalties under the agreement. How can we get to a result where Whirlpool is contractually obligated to pay royalties if Whirlpool didn't contractually obligate itself somewhere in the agreement to do so? The question then is, if paragraph 3 is, and this is the only place that Whirlpool could have done that, if paragraph 3 is an agreement or a promise by Whirlpool to pay royalties, but it's conditional upon an alternative performance, namely to perform under prong 1 and prong 2, then what we have under the rules of contract construction as set forth in the restatement and as recognized by a variety of courts is we have a contract of alternative performances where a promisor has a promise that is conditional upon some event occurring, and that that promisor is the party that's in control of whether that event occurs, then one of two things is going to happen. Either they're going to perform that first promise, in this instance we would submit the first promise is to pay royalties, or they're going to fulfill the condition that excuses them from that performance, which is performance under prongs 1 and prong 2. And under the case law and under the restatement that we've cited, those contracts, once the party makes an election as to which performance it is going to undertake, that becomes the fixed contract. That becomes the terms of the contract. In this instance, Whirlpool unquestionably chose to perform under prongs 1 and prongs 2. We have letters from 1994 and 95 where they say, we are performing and we intend to continue to perform. We have testimony from one of their managers saying, we were getting work to Grigolet because we understood we had a commitment to provide work to Grigolet. And finally, we have 20 years of litigation, or 20 years of performance under this case, 10 years of performance and 10 years of litigation, in which Whirlpool has consistently said, we are performing under prong 2. That's what the entire case ruled. If Whirlpool was contractually obliged to pay monies as royalties when it failed to perform prong 2, which is what the lower court held, it begs the question, well, why? Where did it do that? And we would submit it's in paragraph 3. If Whirlpool truly promised no performance of any kind, it begs this question, then what supports Grigolet's unconditional waiver of its or unconditional grant of the license? What supports Grigolet's unconditional release of its infringement claims? None of those questions can be answered unless we find somewhere in this agreement an obligation undertaken, as Your Honor has indicated, an obligation undertaken by Whirlpool to perform through the payment of royalties. There's no question that paragraph 3, the interpretation we're giving in our view, is consistent. It's consistent with the structure of paragraph 3. Why? Because the subject of the one and only sentence in paragraph 3 is Whirlpool. The agreement says Whirlpool shall not be obligated to pay monies as royalties so long as it performs prongs 1 and prongs 2. The clear inverse of that then has to be true. It is obligated to pay monies as royalties if it does not perform prongs 1 and prongs 2.
We're back to what got me to ask my question. The district judge agreed with that. And the district judge then said, and here's what the royalty rate is. And then, of course, you and Whirlpool reached an agreement that the amount of royalties it owed under that view was $140,000.
Well,
there isn't any holding here that Whirlpool doesn't have to pay royalties. That's what it puzzles
me. We agree with that, that there's no holding that they don't have to pay royalties. What we're saying is that the correct holding back in 2010, when the district judge entered a motion, an order of partial summary judgment at that time, that the correct decision was not that royalties would be owed, but rather that damages for Whirlpool's failure to provide the work under prongs one and prong two, the performance that it elected to perform under prongs one and prong two. It did not elect to pay royalties. It had an obligation to pay royalties.
Your argument then comes down to the proposition that having begun by giving your client more or fair or preferential consideration for Knobs, Whirlpool couldn't change course later. Is that what your argument amounts
Yes, Your
to?
Honor, that's exactly okay. the argument. And we believe that All that's right. the rule under the restatement as well, that what we have here is a contract of alternative performance.
So there's just no question about whether there was a contract or whether Whirlpool has to pay royalties. Everything comes down to your argument that having initially chosen one option, Whirlpool couldn't choose the other option later.
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
And with that, unless the court has questions, we will stand on our briefs with respect to the second argument.
Okay. Certainly, Mr. Lichtenberg.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Ms. Odorizzi.
Michelle Odorizzi for Whirlpool Corporation. I'd like to go right to what counsel said, which is that Whirlpool didn't have the right to change course. The license agreement, as Your Honors know, says Whirlpool is not obligated to pay monies as royalties for the license so long as Whirlpool continued to provide the opportunities in prong one and prong two. By its plain language, that says that Whirlpool could stop at any time providing those opportunities. And the contract itself says what the consequences of that are. Whirlpool will thereafter have to pay royalties. And I think that the case is as simple as that. Now, it is probably true that when the license agreement was written, no one thought that Grigolet would wait until 19 months after this 10-year contract had expired before demanding that there be an arbitration. But the fact that it waited that long can't expand Whirlpool's obligations under this agreement. The obligations, if Whirlpool had stopped at any time during that agreement and said to Grigolet, we just don't want to provide you with those opportunities anymore, then the remedy under the plain language of the agreement would have been you pay monies as royalties for the use of the intellectual property that was licensed here. And it's no different that we have an after-the-fact determination. I think it's a simple case. The district court, in its first summary judgment motion, said that Grigolet's argument seeks to make the interpretation of the license agreement's paragraph 3 complicated instead of simple. And that's what they've done on appeal. But here, it is quite simple. All you need to do is to read the plain language of the agreement, which tells you exactly what happens if Whirlpool stopped supplying those opportunities. Yes, Whirlpool disagreed that it had not done that. It lost the arbitration, but having lost the arbitration, it's now paid the royalties.
Did the district court jump the gun in setting this range for the per unit royalty? Was that actually a live issue that was briefed before the court, or
was
it just unilateral?
It was, Your Honor. The Grigolet argues in its reply brief that the court should not have addressed that issue, which is not an argument they raised in their opening brief. But in any event, the first line of Whirlpool's brief on the cross motions for summary judgment was that 12 cents ought to be a ceiling and should be per part. So it was absolutely
Well, no, litigated. I understand this per part measure was litigated, but my question is whether the 1 cent to 12 cent range, the 12 cent ceiling, was actually a litigated issue, or if the district court kind of got ahead of things in setting that.
It was, Your Honor. Whirlpool argued there should be a 12 cent ceiling, and so Grigolet had an opportunity to respond to that. It responded to that. And what the district court looked at was the testimony of Grigolet's own founder and employees saying 12 cents when they had discussed that during negotiations, they had proposed that, was the reasonable value of the technology from Grigolet's point of view. So what the court said is, well, I'm going to take the range that the parties themselves in the negotiations thought was the value. Whirlpool thought it was a penny apart. Grigolet thought it was 12 cents apart. And the court said, we'll have to come in between that range. And, of course, then the parties went ahead and negotiated within that range. If the court has no questions, we'd ask you to affirm the judgment below. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Anything further, Mr. Lichtenberg?
Yes, Your Honor.
The first thing that I want to point out is, Judge Easterbrook, you have presented the question of, you know, as though it is understood that, of course, Whirlpool made a promise to pay royalties, but that is directly contrary to the position Whirlpool undertook below, has undertaken here, and what the district court found. They found no promise at all to pay royalties, and it is. But I think Your Honor's notion that that was the case is right on point, that there was a promise. And again, on a contract interpretation, once you reach that point, we're off to the
Your position is you're entitled to more than royalties.
Correct. We believe that having elected to perform under prongs one and prongs two,
that transforms this into a requirements contract.
It doesn't into a requirements contract, but it makes it
The measure of damages that you want, right?
The measure of damages would be based upon those programs that were sourced to other parties that the arbitrator has held should have been sourced to Grigolet.
So you want this paragraph 3 treated as a requirements contract once Whirlpool started buying, or continued, not once it started, because it had been buying its needs from your client, but once it continued, in other words, opted what you're calling prongs one and prongs two, as opposed to the payment of royalties.
Well, prong two was the concerned product that didn't exist yet. And all that was being required there was that Whirlpool had to consider
future work.
Right.
Right.
And if they excluded us from future work, if they excluded Grigolet from future work, then they had liability for that exclusion.
Right.
So I'm not sure that's a requirements contract, as I'm understanding it, Your Honor, but perhaps I'm not.
Well, that's what I understand your argument to be, that you want it treated that way once Whirlpool continued its course of conduct of buying its knobs needs from your client, that it could not opt to pay royalties instead and was stuck with the requirements language that's in paragraph 3.
It was required from that point forward to continue to give consideration.
How do you reconcile that reading with the so long as language, which appears to leave room for an alternate measure or an alternate payment of royalties in exchange for the use of patents?
I would make a couple of observations about the so long as language. First, so long as can be used both with a temporal quality, which is what Your Honor and what Whirlpool is now arguing, but it also can mean simply be words of condition, which is what Whirlpool below actually argued, that it means provided, if, on the condition that. That it is only in this court that now Whirlpool is adopting that and saying, it actually has a temporal quality, that it means for the duration that. And we don't believe that that's necessarily the interpretation that's required or the one that is correct.
Thank you. Nothing further. Thank you, Burke. Case is taken under advisement.